Excuse me. I also took the opportunity whilst I was getting a parcel from the door to steal one of my parents' biscuits again, so you can now hear me chewing.
Once you've swallowed that mouthful, by all means, answer the question. We can hang on for you if you like.
There we go. I think I'm ready.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Remember the good old days when you'd dread the weekend because it was time for Manchester City to lose another game? There's old Spider-Man actors playing Spider-Man, Gladiator is back in the cinemas, Oasis are back together, and City are on a run of four defeats in a row. I don't want to alarm anyone, but I think my time machine might work. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon Podcast, where we're going to preview the upcoming matches against Tottenham and Feyenoord. How can the team put an end to their recent poor form and get back into the saddle for the season? Let's find out. We'll get insight into both opponents and find out what's been happening with them so far this season, as we hear from Jack from Rule the Roost and Luke from a Feyenoord podcast that translates essentially as no bullshit. On top of that, Dan Burke's been taking a look at all of the City Academy graduates that have scored for their countries. Taylor Harwood-Bellis became the 19th player to do it on Sunday with his goal for England against the Republic of Ireland, so we'll hear all about the 18 others a bit later on. I'm David Mooney, and with me I've got two City fans this week. I am joined by Richard Burns.
Hello, David. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad, thank you. And Rachel Hurdson's with us. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad. How are things?
Yeah, all good, thank you. Good. Other than the run of form, yeah, but other than that, City aside, yeah, all great.
Excellent stuff. Well, you say City aside, all great, because there's one thing that I didn't mention in that intro, because before we get into everything there, it's been reported this week that Guardiola is to sign on the dotted line. The Athletic Sam Lee broke the story, so to get us across it, I got him to send us this voice note.
I'm sure you've seen the news, and the basic facts are pretty simple to digest. Guardiola's agreed to stay. I think he signed the contract already. It's for 1 year, and there's an option for another year. And the other part of the news is it's going to be announced, as far as I know, unless things have changed, on Thursday. So yeah, that's pretty easy to digest and simple to explain, but I've been told to talk for 2 or 3 minutes. So if you're interested in the background of how the story came about, I can't say too much. But I got a tip off about it from a colleague on Monday night while I was sitting down watching the new City documentary, which is pretty good, to be fair. You should check that out, especially now with Pep staying. You can see all the glory of Pep and what he's about in this documentary, and that ties up quite nicely, actually. But yeah, I got a tip off about it. Couldn't get anywhere. Spent all day on Tuesday, little hints here and there. The info growing more and more steady during the day. Loads of different things, voice notes cropping up at random, people getting back to me with stuff. You know, official requests for information and official responses and all this kind of stuff. And then finally got over the line about 8:30. Once I got all the assurances I needed from a good contact, that's how these stories kind of come about. It's quite interesting the route that things have taken. I think in the summer, the expectation at City was that Guardiola was going to leave at the end of this current contract with Cheeky, and obviously we know from the last international window that Cheeky is going to go, and it was obviously very tempting then to be like, oh, that might mean Guardiola's going as well, especially with the England stuff floating about. And then as soon as the England stuff started to disappear, or disappeared immediately with the Thomas Tuchel news, it started to come out and be said a bit more behind the scenes that if anything, Guardiola's more likely to stay and sign a 1 year deal, and that's been the direction of it ever since. And in his recent press conferences, when he's talked about having more desire than ever to stay and get the team back to the top, if you look at it in hindsight now, I think, you know, he was telling us that's what was going to happen. Obviously, as the international break went on, this international break, you start to think, oh, if he doesn't sign it now, when is he actually going to sign it? But yeah, they'd obviously worked on it last week, possibly signed it Monday, possibly last week. And yeah, everything's kind of developed quickly from there. So all that's left now is the official confirmation, which I'm sure we're all looking forward to. Nobody more so than myself. And then we'll see where, I don't know, the final Pep era, the end of the Pep era takes us.
The Blue Moon Podcast. If City won't let you down on the pitch, let us let you down off it instead.
There we go. Rachel, so that immediately your reaction to the news that Guardiola is going to stay for at least one more year, maybe two more years, that it must have brightened up your week despite four defeats in a row.
Yeah, it absolutely has. It's definitely given those City fans a massive lift, although there'll be a collective sigh of exasperation across fans of all other Premier League clubs, I'm sure. But yeah, it's brilliant news. He's not only delivered silverware, though, Pep. He's totally revolutionised English football. You know, I quite often go to watch Ulti now, and the way that they try and emulate sort of playing out from the back, it's the blueprint for a lot of teams technically now, how Pep plays. You know, the inverted fullbacks, defenders dropping into midfield when we're attacking, winning the league without a striker, he's done it all. So, yeah, he's already seen Klopp off, and there's others, like I say, that might be... might be boiling a little bit of urine, I think, shall we say. However, I do think, you know, the club will undoubtedly now be planning for such a time when Pep decides that he is going to go, and they will have a succession plan of sorts in place. It's brilliant that now has been deferred for yet another season. You only have to look across the road to see, you know, the potential drop off of what happens when one of the most successful managers ever decides to leave. Have taken from this as well that he's still got a lot of faith in this team and what they can achieve. Whereas I know when Sir Alex Ferguson left United, I think that, you know, he had an ageing squad and he knew that was the right time to go, because I think they were potentially going to have a detrimental impact on his record. Whereas this says to me, Pep still has absolutely the confidence in the team, the club, and I think he'll have it's I'm taking this, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think it could potentially be a sign as well that these 115 charges that have been, you know, overshadowing us for quite some time, that they won't be upheld. I don't think they'll, you know, again, I might be right reading too much into that, but it says to me that the club and Pep have confidence that they'll come to nothing, we won't be punished, and therefore it'll be business as usual.
Yeah, they're certainly confident, that's the thing, isn't it? Richard, it looks like a one-year deal with an option of another. It will surely be Guardiola that triggers that option of another, because if City could just trigger it unilaterally, they'd do it immediately, wouldn't they? So it's like it's obviously like if Guardiola wants to stay. But you look at the previous times he's done it, like... It feels like there's always an itch there that City might get him to have to scratch it.
Yeah, and I think the 1+1 seems a pretty smart thing to do from City's point of view, because it gives, like, Pep is unquestionably, I mean, to use his words directly from the end of last season, he is closer to leaving than starting. Like, he's not going to do another decade, is he? That seems almost impossible that he would do that. But the 1+1, I think, it obviously gives City some element of confidence and some indication that he might well stay on for another year after the next one. And that's got to be a good thing for any prospective new signings as well, right? So say, well, look, yeah, we can't 100% guarantee you that you'll be working with Pep for 2 years, but would he have accepted the extension option? Would he have accepted that in his contract if he was definitely leaving? Like, of course he wouldn't. So I think it's a great selling point to prospective signings, and, you know, just like, I guess, giving just some confidence in the club more generally. I would play devil's advocate ever so slightly to I guess be a bit contrary on one of Rachel's points. So I wonder whether, rather than it being a display of confidence from Pep in the current team and what there is left to achieve with it, I wonder whether it's more a display of confidence in that the club will back him to completely refresh it and overhaul it. And I mean, don't get me wrong.
Well, the thing is, though, either way, if it's either one of them, that's a good thing.
No, I completely agree, and that's why I say it's a bit devil's advocate, because either way, it's confidence from Pep that he can achieve what he wants to with the club. But I wonder whether the excitement and scratching the itch might stem more from, I guess, like what would be sort of Pep City 3.0 at this stage, because I think we all expect De Bruyne and Walker as two stalwarts to leave in the summer, and it, you know, that feels about right, I think. So certainly on Walker's side, I think those things feel right to everybody. But they will need replacing. The club, the squad is already deliberately small, and we're finally sort of having to lie in the bed that we consistently make in that regard. Injuries are having a very significant impact because we have a small squad, and it hasn't really been refreshed very much over the last few years. And I don't think Pep would sign a contract without some assurance that the club will be seeking to, like, seriously add to the squad, because I think they have to. It's not sustainable to keep winning titles with the squad as it is now. We've got some great servants, but it is time to bring in some new blood, I think. But either way, I mean, it's clearly an expression of confidence in whichever way you look at it. And I just think it's really exciting. Like, obviously, who would ever want Pep to leave? But there are ways of looking at, like, if it was just a 1-year extension and it was primarily with the current squad, like, there is a way of looking at that and saying, what is there to gain from that? But it's not. I'm confident that this means that there will be a decent amount of new signings, and that there's probably a very strong chance that he will exercise that extra year, as long as he's happy that there's still something to do with it.
Yeah. Rachel, just on the charges, you mentioned giving you an air of confidence. The little devil on my shoulder's going, you know what? It would be very Guardiola to accept a contract extension with the threat of having to manage in the bottom tier of England.
Yeah, nothing would surprise me. I think it was really interesting as well, this whole deliberation around the England role. You know, I've read that, you know, over the last 24 hours, obviously, and I expect there to be quite a few more column inches dedicated to this over the coming days. But there does seem to be this indication that he was giving the England job real consideration as well, which has surprised me. I didn't think that was necessarily the way that he would go. But yeah, who knows? I've you know, given up trying to second guess Guardiola a long time ago, yeah, to be perfectly blunt. So,
yeah. Any worries that this is ultimately a speculation killer with the plus one? Because Pellegrini did that in 2015-16. He signed an extension ahead of that season with everybody behind the scenes, certainly not outwardly, knowing full well that Guardiola was the plan in 2016. Any concerns that this could just be a case of they're just killing any sort of speculation for the end of the season? He'll do another year, but that'll be it.
I don't think so. I think, you know, what is next for Pep? You know, I think he has sort of indicated that he'd probably want to take a break. But I find that incredible. When you watch all these documentaries, you do see that he lives and breathes it. Even when he's on the plane coming back from games, he's sat there watching our next opposition and looking at tactics, et cetera, et cetera. For me, I don't think he's somebody who could even really function without football. So I think as long as we want him, he will absolutely stay. I don't think it's necessarily helped the speculation, but I don't think it's, you know, can be a huge contributory factor to our recent form. But it doesn't help. So I guess, yeah, having him sign on the dotted line is good for everybody, isn't it? So I'm just going to try and take it at face value and not read too much into it for now.
Yeah. Richard, we're going to come on to the Tottenham game shortly, but any kind of hope of an immediate form boost off this now, given that I vividly remember them announcing him a contract extension in 2019 and then immediately losing to Spurs?
I didn't recall that detail. That absolutely has to be the hope. You would imagine that the atmosphere will be heightened at the game on Saturday. It's usually a good atmosphere against Spurs anyway. It's obviously a big game for lots of reasons. Like, they have to arrest this form. And yeah, I think there has to be a possibility of a bounce there, doesn't there? And if this, like, injecting a bit of much needed momentum. I think the other comparable for me, I guess in a polar opposite kind of way, but comparable all the same, was the charges being announced before the Villa game. And we then beat a decent, were they decent then? Maybe not. We beat Villa, was it 4-1? Played them off the park.
Villa were very decent then, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic atmosphere. And that was sort of the start of the turnaround in the treble season. So there's definitely, I suppose it doesn't give you a chance to build a siege mentality, because it's essentially continuation of the same. But you've got to think it's a boost for the players to know that Pep is staying. I think at whatever point that he does go, given his relationship with the club, I am sure Pep will give somewhere around this amount of notice when it is his final season. So at some point, we're going to have to deal with the reality of Pep leaving and a countdown to that, and whatever impact that has on whatever season that falls in. But I'm glad it's not this season. And you know, I'm glad we're not coming off the back of a run of form where it already looks quite difficult to win the league. Like, you know, that is the reality of it. No team has ever lost the league from the position that Liverpool are in. So it is going to be tough. But that would be harder if there was a feeling of this being like Pep's procession to a grand farewell, I think.
Allegedly, Rodri's there Saturday bringing his Ballon d'Or, isn't he? So that, coupled with the Pep extension, if that doesn't get the crowd going, then nothing will.
Yeah. We'll talk about Spurs in a minute. If you want to hear more from Sam, we did a full Let Me Talk podcast on Tuesday evening about the Guardiola news. So you can head over to lmtpod.com and sign up for that. Quick plug for my other work there.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Time to look ahead to that Spurs game now. And Rachel, thanks to Marcus Lowe on this one, who got in touch with us to point out that San Marino are in better form than City right now. City have won 2 and lost 4 of their last 6. Of their last 6, San Marino have won 2, drawn 1 and lost 3. So they've got a slightly better record than City have over the last 6 games. That's a crisis, isn't it?
You see, people are saying it's a great time to play us. I completely disagree. I think it's the wrong time to play us, because this has now become, for me, an absolute win. You know, win at all costs. Performance doesn't matter. You know, we played pretty well against Bournemouth and against Sporting Lisbon in the first half. That didn't matter at the end of the day, did it? So, for me, there is real psychological damage if we don't win. It will damage our mentality. We've got to get back on that horse. And Spurs are massively inconsistent themselves as well. I think that's their fans' biggest frustration. They've got some real talent in their team, and we all know what Son likes to do against City as well.
Yeah, well, Son, Kulusevski, there's loads of them, isn't there? Yeah,
of course there is. Yeah. But Son's the worst one. He's always dangerous against us. But anyway, hoping we stop the rot with the save that was made last season. Well, that was Son, wasn't it? I think
it was Son. Yeah.
So maybe that's the tide's turned on that one now. But yeah, I think it's a really dangerous time to play us. I think that we've got to get back to winning ways. And if I was Postecoglou, I would have that in the back of my mind, not fancying coming to City at all. Especially the Saturday evening game. It's Saturday evening, isn't it?
Yeah,
the Saturday evening game. Yeah. To me, the atmosphere is always that little bit better on a Saturday evening as well. Don't know what it is about it rather than 3 o'clock. Maybe people have got more booze inside them. I don't know. But it always seems to add to the atmosphere as well. So I'm really, really looking forward to this one.
Yeah. Richard, through the other side of the international break now, it's almost been a chance to kind of get away, get a bit of energy in the legs, you know, blow the cobwebs away. We'll find out later in the week about the injury situation, but, there's likely to be a few more players closer to being fit as well. How much will the last 10 days have just really helped, just having some time off?
I think it's got to help. And there's again, there's always different ways of looking at it. So like one of the things that City are ordinarily very good at is bouncing back after a defeat. And so like City usually relish playing a game straight after a defeat, because it's a chance to put things right, let out some frustrations. And it's why, you know, it's a very cliched thing to say that like that's the kind of thing that champions do, and City are experts at it. But clearly, the recent run of form has seen them fail to do that for the first time in many, many, many years, and the first time that Pep's really experienced it. So I think under the circumstances, just taking a bit of a break from each other. There have been some reports of like some tensions within the squad, and I think that's probably quite normal when you're on a losing run and when it's something that that you're just not really used to.
When you watch the documentaries, it's quite normal in a winning run as well.
yeah, absolutely. And so that's not, you know, it doesn't concern me. But just the fact that those reports, I suppose you don't usually hear about them in a winning run, and now they come out because it's a bit more of a story because City aren't doing very well. And you know, that's fair enough. So I think just a chance to take a bit of a break from each other. For those who were on international duty, to, you know, like Haaland going getting a hat trick, and that kind of thing, it should give them a bit of a positive feeling. Hopefully they'll look forward to seeing each other again and getting back into a City shirt and the chance to put things right. And yeah, so I think the break can only really have done them good. Unfortunately, I don't think a break is the answer to all of the what I will loosely call problems, because I'm very aware that problems that City have are still they're quite privileged problems to have as a fan of a successful football team. There are issues within City's squad and the makeup of the squad and how easy City are to attack against that won't be solved by simply having a rest. But as it is, a rest, I think, is a or a break from each other is probably a pretty handy thing to have had.
Yeah. Let's get the Spurs view on things. I started here by asking Jack from Rule the Roost if they needed the international break as much as City did.
It's really, really hard to say. You've seen our form this season, haven't you? Look, I mean, the big sort of conversation at the moment amongst Spurs fans is the underlying data. The underlying data suggests that Spurs are really, really good and doing really good things. We just maybe don't quite have the players to pull off the really good things that Postecoglou is kind of laying the foundations of. And other people are suggesting that, well, you know, surely a great coach would be able to kind of work with what he's got. And then that falls into conversations about, well, Pep Guardiola needed a certain amount of players at Manchester City, and so on and so forth. So, look, I mean, I think this is probably the most polarized, not in terms of fan sentiment, but just in terms of form and performance level iteration of Spurs I've maybe ever seen. Because when we're good under Postecoglou, we're really, really good. We're really great. We knock the ball about really nicely. It looks like everybody knows what they're doing. It looks like everybody's working hard, working for each other. Looks like we finally got some identity again after, I mean, it's 5 years today on the day of recording. We got rid of Maurizio Pochettino and we've had no identity since that point whatsoever. But then we have days like Crystal Palace away at Selhurst Park. We have days like against Ipswich at White Hart Lane, where two teams that we get handed their first victories of the season to, and we just look completely devoid of anything, any spirit, any idea, any plan, any purpose. It's really, really strange, and it's really hard to get a full kind of handle on things.
Is the good elements and the bad elements, are they whole games or are they periods in games?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'd say it varies, but more often than not, and I mean, I'll probably get pinged for being negative. I tend to think Spurs only ever really look good in these kind of like real intense phases of matches where we can just absolutely blitz an opponent, right, for a short amount of time. And we can, as you've seen some of our results, when we can score 3-4 goals in the space of 8-12 minutes or something like that. When the game has maybe looked a bit more balanced otherwise. I would say that quite often, though, the thing is, even when Spurs lose games, like maybe the Ipswich game's a bad example because Ipswich were actually really good and really good value for their point but Crystal Palace, for example, it felt like we overall controlled the match, controlled the flow of the game, just didn't really carve out any meaningful opportunities, and Palace seized on theirs. So again, mate, it's as clear as mud, basically, at Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the style then, because I mean, a lot has been made about the Postecoglou style, you know, the high line, the quick play, that sort of thing. City right now are obviously trying to work out what to do with no Rodri in the centre of the pitch, at the same time as having a little bit of an injury crisis. We don't know the extent of the players that will and won't be available for weekend just yet. How are you feeling about the prospect of being able to play through City this weekend?
I don't know. I mean, it all depends, because again, one of the bigger issues at Spurs is we never tend to know what our settled starting lineup is. We have an ongoing thing with James Maddison right now, who seems to have been, I mean, probably to say he's been jettisoned from the team is dramatic, but for a player that's started the season as a vice captain, is probably one of the poster boys, if you like, of Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, to not be starting games, to be getting, I think it was about 12 minutes at the end of the Ipswich game when we were desperate for a goal, you could say he's fallen out of favour, at least. But there's to this point, there's been a lot of kind of flip-flopping between him and Kulusevski to be that main, that basically the main man in the middle, the main kind of at least attacking outlet in the center of the park. Kulusevski has often been pushed out wide, but has, you know, has been demonstrably always much better when he's played in a central role. And I think they've been trying to facilitate James Maddison for quite a while, but Kulusevski's made such a good case for himself to start that he probably will. And now I guess it would be Bissouma and Saar who start behind him. Rodrigo Bentancur has obviously made that selection a bit easier because he's just been banned for 7 games for being a racist, basically. Mm. So I would imagine it'll be those three. And I tend to think that is our best midfield. I tend to think that when Spurs are at their best, it's when those three are at their best. Pape Matasar is, I think he's an astounding young player. I think he's really, really exciting, a really exciting player for the future. Doesn't mean he's without faults, as is the case with most young players. You know, they'll have games where they're just not quite at it or it's just not going for them. But there's enough there to say that he's going to be a very important player, hopefully, for Spurs for a long time. Yves Bissouma is capable of being absolutely brilliant when he fancies it. And Dejan Kulusevski being our player of the season. So, yeah, I mean, I would say we are relishing probably the opportunity of playing Manchester, a Rodri-less Manchester City. But, you know, it's still got Kovacic, you've still got Ilkay Gundogan. Like, you can never take that for granted. Just, you know, the sort of strength and depth that Manchester City have. And I'm never going to sit here as a Spurs fan and say in anything other than a kind of, haha, we always beat you, isn't it funny kind of way, that we're going to turn up and really kind of look forward to playing through Manchester City, if you like.
Yeah, it does. It's a weird one that this weekend does feel very much at the moment. The way these two teams have been going into the international break, it feels like the resistible force meeting the movable object. So like you don't really know which way it's going to go. Yeah. I'm interested in certainly Spurs defensively at the moment because, I mean, you speak to opposition fans and rival fans, you'll talk about players like Romero and such being a little bit, let's say, hot-headed. And then you've got somebody like Mickey van der Ven, who, you know, is widely regarded as quite the opposite of that. City at the moment, unless if Haaland isn't scoring, City are really struggling to score. So, like, does that give you confidence ahead of this weekend?
Again, mate. Like, I'm sorry to sound like a broken record here, but our settled defence with Van de Ven being out, like he's injured for the foreseeable, he might be back. I think there was some talk that he might be back after the international break. Maybe. I'd be surprised. I think he did his hamstring again, albeit just lightly. And if he's not back, then it will be hopefully Romero, but he's limped off during international duty. So we could well be looking at Radu Dragosin and Ben Davis as our centre-back pairing going into this Manchester City game. Christian Romero, it seems silly to say, and I am probably being a little churlish, doesn't feel like as much of a loss because he's not been at his best this season. It feels like his head's been turned a little bit, but that's purely speculation. But he's on the pitch, at least he's not been at his very best. So it feels like less of a blow than Van de Ven. But when the alternative is Radu Dragosin, who has shown he's a very capable defender during the Euros when he was playing for Romania, but has, without being overly harsh, looked anything but in the time he's played for Spurs. He's one of those players that's got one of those really mouthy agents that can't stop talking to the press all the time, saying, my player needs to get... Well, when we first signed him, he openly said it's going to be good because Spurs will be a good stepping stone to Barcelona for Radu. And then after that point, he's just been complaining about the lack of game time he's been getting. When more often than not, when Radu Dragosin gets an opportunity, he does something silly and messes up and doesn't make a great case for himself. I think he is a player that probably is a capable footballer, has some ability in there. And I'm sure you know this feeling quite well, because I think this has happened to City quite a few times. One of those players that you just know has never really looked that good when they've played for your club, and they end up signing for somebody in La Liga, somebody in Serie A, and they look great, and everyone says, ah, look, you sold that player. Look how amazing they are. And it doesn't really cut that deep, because you know it just wasn't happening for them for one reason or another. And it feels like Dragosin could be one of those players. You could see him rocking up, go back to the Serie A, something like that, and playing for Juventus and looking brilliant and being a Champions League level defender for a long time. However,
the Jerome Boateng of Spurs, yeah.
Yeah, his time at Spurs, it just hasn't looked that good. Ben Davis is Ben Davis. Like, he's a capable 7 out of 10 player most games he plays. You're never going to look at Ben Davis as being at fault for something massively. I think you could probably count the amount of errors he's given, you know, leading to a goal, probably on one hand over his Tottenham career. However, if he is coming up against a fully fit and firing Erling Haaland, then it's probably going to go one way. But, you know, it's again, mate, it's this kind of state of flux that Spurs are in all over the pitch. And this probably contributes to the bigger picture, in that we have so many players who can be really, really good, but can also be really, really bad. there's a lack of consistency there across the park. And defensively speaking, we've got Destiny Adoghi and Pedro Porro, who are both in the same boat at the moment, out on the wings, who are two clearly very talented players who are both quite bad at defending, but absolutely exceptional more often than not going forwards. Are perfect for this Ange Postecoglou system, but both have probably a howler in their locker defensively, are known to switch off, and are both not in very good form at the moment either. So again, I wouldn't say we're coming into this one, mate, kind of with boundless enthusiasm and like we're going to do something, but you know, and I hate to be trite about it, but you know how this often goes, Spurs against Manchester City, inexplicably so.
Yeah.
So I kind of get why you generally have more trepidation coming into this picture than I can, you know, fathom at times.
Yeah, the one at the end of last season, mate, it was the worst of all worlds, because we know how those games go, and yet we had to win it. It was horrid.
I'll go back to that one. It was an unpleasant day for everyone.
Well, let's go back to the one earlier this season, because as much as City were a little bit of a rotated side, there was a few youngsters in there, and you could see the intent towards the end of the game with the substitutions they were making. There is an element of being able to read something from that game, because you certainly look at the way that Spurs broke through City in that second half at times. How are you finishing chances at the moment? Because I seem to remember you had a couple of absolute stonewall chances at the end of that game that you just didn't take. And at the same time, it feels like City are giving up more opportunities than normal this season.
More often than not, Spurs score goals by somebody on the wing, be it Johnson or Werner, getting on the end of something that has been whipped into the box. Just because of the way that we play. Not so much Timo Werner, because he doesn't really score. I'm talking mainly in that Manchester City game. But we do just seem to play that, the wing play, sweep balls into the box, create opportunities along the ground, and try and get somebody on the end of it. Just fizz those dangerous balls across the box and see if somebody can get there. Dominic Solanke's been doing a decent enough job of that. Probably
Kulusevski always scares me.
Yeah, Dominic Solanke's overall contribution has been more outside of the box, or kind of outside of scoring, I would say. It's one of those where people will sort of look from the outside and be like, he's done all right. When he's actually been really good for us. He's been really, really good. Probably one of the best big money signings we've ever made, dare I say. But yeah, Brennan Johnson scores a lot because he's quick and he's got a good knack of getting into the right place at the right time. I think the jury's still out on quite how good or not he is right now, but I think he's a good, talented player. And Dejan Kulusevski can, as you were saying there, can always do something. Quite mad. He went through a phase of not really liking shooting. I think his confidence dipped a little bit last season. And he'd often try and overplay things, often try to look for somebody else to sort of, you know, hand the ball off to instead of just having a whack. When we first signed him, he'd often just kind of shoot on sight and stuff like that. And he seems to be getting a bit of that back again. He's a lovely, lovely player. But yeah, for the most part, mate, if we just watch the wings, we're gonna fizz balls into the box and try get a foot or something on the end of it. That's generally what we tend to do.
Yeah, well, we can put it off no longer. Charity bet time, score prediction needed. What are you going for this one?
I have a feeling. I have a bad feeling. It could be quite an ugly one for Spurs. This one. I've got a sinking feeling. It could be like a 3-4 nil to you. I really do. I just don't know. We've got a bit of a whiff about us at the moment, mate. I'm not sure we're in that good of a place, and I could see City taking this as an opportunity to kind of right a few wrongs of of your sort of bizarro form at the moment. I think you might put us to bed in this one, to be honest.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Jack from Rule the Roost. Rachel, you know that, as you referenced earlier on, that Spurs are a bogey side for City. City, we've seen this season, can be played through quite easily. Spurs are a team that could quite easily do some of the playing through as well. Does that give you any nerves for this weekend?
Yeah, it does. It does, because I think Pep has persisted with playing this high line, and I just think they've got the players to really run through us, like you said. God knows what we're going to put out defensively as well. That to me has been one of the biggest issues this season, in that I don't think we've played the same back four twice, or if we have, probably not in consecutive games.
And you look at the way some of them have played as well, it's been clear they've been carrying injuries, so they've just kind of had to be there and kind of do what you can.
Yeah, and I think maybe when we've played the back line in the past, I think with Walker at right back, we always had that guarantee of the recovery pace as well. When Diaz is in, he just looked that much more organised, because I think he brings something from a leadership perspective as well. So I have got concerns about the fact that they can hurt us. I always remember under Mancini, his tactic seemed to be shut up shop first. Let's start from the back and stop conceding goals. And when we stop conceding, then once we've sort of addressed that, then we'll sort out the attacking options. I think we've always got goals in us. Obviously, Haaland is in a rich vein of form. I am a little bit concerned about the lack of contribution from midfield for goals this season. You know, in the past, we've had De Bruyne and Foden, Bernardo weighing in. Obviously, you know, we've had injuries this season, so they've not been able to help out. But yeah, if Haaland gets injured, then we really are screwed. But yeah, I Spurs are pretty inconsistent, though. You don't know what you're going to get with them. You know, I've seen Maddison. I remember watching, I think he was against Leicester earlier this season. Was it against Leicester? And Maddison was absolutely brilliant from start to finish. He reminded me very much of David Silva, the way he was dictating the play. since then he's not done a great deal, but he might turn silver-esque again on Saturday. You just don't know.
Yeah.
Hopefully not, obviously. But yeah, so as much as we've, you know, got the attacking prowess in Haaland, it does concern me the defence. It does obviously Rodri being out has been well spoken about, and the fact that we've almost got no choice other than to play Gundogan and Kovacic there, and I think their lack of energy is and I wouldn't say fitness necessarily, but I would say that, you know, they look tired in the second half, and that's probably contributed to our poor second half performances, that we have probably been a bit worn down. I would like on that, I mean, again, don't want to criticise Pep, but if I had one criticism, it would be, why not use your subs earlier? You know, you talk about the tiredness in the squads. Okay, get that. But why then are we insisting on not changing it until much, much later on? Really, a couple of those games have really needed an injection of energy off the bench. That said, who does he bring off the bench at the minute? Pretty depleted choices. So, yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting on Saturday. But like I say, for me, I'm not too bothered about the performance. I'm bothered about the result. That's got to stop the rot. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Richard, we've heard from Jack there as well that Spurs are feeling a bit shaky. They obviously lost to Ipswich before the international break. There is an element here that City, as Rachel says, do need to get their attacking mojo back, because if Haaland isn't scoring, there's nobody who has been scoring really recently. Is this creating chances? Is this taking chances? Is this the wingers need to step up and get a few goals themselves? Like what is it, do you think?
I mean, really, there's a bit of everything. I think Haaland, I suppose, is the first point to start with, because he's, you know, obviously he had an absolutely extraordinary start to the season. Hat tricks, goals every game, all different types of goals. And I think what we're seeing at the moment in a City shirt, at least, maybe not so much for Norway, given his antics during the international break, scoring himself a hat trick again. But in a City shirt, he definitely seems to be a bit less ruthless during this run. I think even if you look at his goal at Brighton, his first attempt at the finish wasn't brilliant. You know, it was a really good chance that he required to sort of chase through to knock it in on the rebound, which, you know, is fine. But I think the first finish is probably one that he buries in those first few games of the season.
We had this last week with Adam and Joe. It was a good save. I don't know what everybody...
You're part of that goalkeepers union, aren't you, David?
It's a good save.
It can be two things at once, though, right? You can still say that he could have done better. I'm obviously going to refuse to give the goalkeeper any credit just to annoy you. I think, but there's also, we're back into that sort of situation where there's definitely been games where it's felt he's not contributed a lot, but that is just how we play Haaland and how we use him, and that is his game. But it is one of those things where if the team aren't doing well and Haaland isn't scoring the chances that do come his way, then like the effect of having him there is somewhat negated. And so to relieve that, you absolutely need other players to step up, and it is one of those situations. Again, I think this might have been said by Adam and or Joe last week, that it does start to paint letting Alvarez go in a slightly different light. And I say letting him go, he wanted to go, and that is a policy that City generally have, that if they can facilitate that when a player doesn't want to be there, then it makes sense to let them go. And I wasn't concerned about it in the summer, but he was a good option to have. He did generally have a decent goal scoring record, and there just isn't really anybody stepping up with that at the moment. And it does feel like chance creation is reduced a little bit. Last year we had Foden, who was popping up with, was it two hat tricks he got, and those chances that would fall to him around the edge of the box always felt like there was at least a 50-50 chance he'd be at the very least working the keeper, if not popping them into the top corner. And a lot of that, like, it isn't really there. And when all of that comes together, I think it just makes everything feel a bit more of a slog. And creates a feeling of it's hard to get anything going, it's hard to be creative. But I also think this obsession, and again, understandable obsession with controlling a game, is heightened because we are so vulnerable when we're attacked. So the imperative to not lose the ball in a team that is already obsessed with keeping the ball, the imperative to not lose it, like, it probably reduces some risk taking, but the risk of when we do lose the ball is then so heightened because we are relatively easy to get at. And we're in that phase where, you know, I mean, conceding four at Sporting Lisbon with two penalties and conceding two late on, where there was like a definite momentum shift against Brighton after a really good first half. It just feels like not scoring enough goals obviously increases the pressure on the defence to keep a clean sheet, and we're currently incapable of keeping a clean sheet. So it's like, it's just a perfect storm of things. And I don't think you can fix it by just addressing one of them. It all has to work in tandem. But if Haaland gets a hat trick, then we'll probably be okay.
Yeah. Hey ho. So it's only Spurs. What's there to worry about there? there's also Feyenoord in the midweek afterwards, Rachel. And weirdly, given City's Champions League position in the table and the fact that they still have PSG and Juventus away, it kind of feels like there's pressure on this one to win it as well.
Yeah, I think so. But again, we're at home, so chance to put things right. I'm always much more confident of us when we're at home. No discredit, no disrespect to Feyenoord. I know they've had some good away wins, haven't they, at Benfica and Girona, but they're fourth in what is a, am I allowed to say, tin pot league? so yeah, write them off at your peril. But at the same time, I'm very confident.
And Richard, I mean, as Rachel's saying there, like Feyenoord, as good as they've been away from home at various points in the Champions League this season, coming to City should be a different prospect for them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously City have an incredible record in the Champions League. It's on a game-by-game basis. The defeat against Sporting was the first, and was it 28 games? Obviously a record-breaking run of undefeated games. The record at the Etihad in the Champions League is absolutely astonishing. I feel the need in asking this question to check that the game actually is at the Etihad.
Yes, it is. Don't worry.
I suddenly doubted myself. Don't say something completely nonsensical. City's record at the Etihad in the Champions League is astonishing, with the exception of the Madrid penalty shootout. It's what, 2019, was it? The last defeat, that Lyon game that Arteta managed. So any team going to the Etihad in the Champions League should find it difficult. And like you say, City are the pot one team, and whatever Feyenoord's away record is won't scare City. And I suppose it's just back down to, I'm not going to pretend that I know a lot about Feyenoord's style of play, so it's back down to the, do they feel confident enough to come and try and attack what has been a faltering back line? And teams have seized the opportunity to counter-attack City and get at them on this transition. If Feyenoord feel that they can exploit that, then maybe it makes for an interesting game and something other than damage limitation. But it is one where hopefully not misplaced confidence given our current run of form. But it is one where I think City should be looking at this as a home win, and anything less would be an extremely disappointing result.
Yeah. Rachel, the other side of this as well is obviously Spurs at home, Feyenoord at home. Do you think part of the four in a row defeats has been exacerbated by the fact that they've had four away games in a row as well? Because home games are different, aren't they?
Most definitely. Had one of those four games been played at home, I think we would have won. We would have had the opportunity to stop the rot. I can't wait to get back to the Etihad because it feels like it's been a long time since we've been there, to be perfectly frank. With those four away games plus the international break, I'm looking forward to a run of games at the Etihad now. And like I say, our home form is incredible. You know, we've done... I can't remember the last time we lost there now, actually.
Was it Brentford
before the World Cup? Yeah. And that was a weird game in that a lot of the players had already sort of checked out and didn't want to get injured before they went. Had that not been played at that time, again, would we potentially have won? Possibly. Who knows? But yeah, no, I think that definitely the four away games on the bounce is a contributing factor. But props to all the City fans who actually went to all four games as well, of which there were a few. It's not like they're around the corner either, is it? It's not just down the road. They're all... you know, some substantial distances away. So kudos to any Blues that went to all four games.
Yeah. We'll do predictions for these games shortly, but first let's hear a bit more about Feyenoord. I've been speaking to Luke Flens. Here he is explaining the name of the podcast that he does.
You can call it Kein Gelul, which means no bullshit, don't talk too much. It's a saying of a former manager of Feyenoord, Ernst Happel. And he was more like, don't bullshit, don't talk too much, just play football.
I didn't attempt to do the pronunciation of the podcast name for obvious reasons. I started by asking how they were feeling about coming to the Etihad.
About a game against Man City?
Yeah.
Yeah, easy win. Nah, of course, this is, I think, the biggest name that we drawed. Very difficult match, obviously, especially away. I mean, at home, sometimes we have a magical evening in the Cup. But Man City away is, I think, a bridge too far, most likely. But yeah, it's a good experience for the team and obviously a nice away day. So we as a fans are pretty happy that we can come to Manchester again.
Yeah. In terms of form at the moment, obviously we're speaking before the weekend's game. So yeah. You still have another league game to go before the game with City. How are things going right now?
Yeah, we had a bit of a rough start this season. We had a couple of draws against lower ranked teams, let's say. So yeah, it wasn't too easy. And then we played against your satellite club, Girona, in the Champions League away. And that one we won. So we were pretty happy with that. And that was kind of the let's say, the start of a better series. So we had a couple of good wins. Pretty important one home against FC Twente. We won actually away at Benfica, which was massive for us. And then a couple of good matches. But then, let's say, last couple of weeks, we played Ajax at home, which we were supposed to win, I think, but then we lost it. And then also Red Bull Salzburg at home, which we lost. So we had a rough last week, let's say, before the international break. So yeah, it's a bit hard to say. I mean, when Slot left the club, he left the club very well managed, good squad, everybody was happy. But then, the new head coach, Priske, came in and he started to change a lot. And we still, let's say, adapting a bit to that.
Yeah, just looking at the table, currently in fourth in the table, eight points off the top. How are you feeling about it all at the moment?
Yeah, I think at the end of the season, we should be at the top two. I think PSV might be a bit too good for us this year. But I mean, when you look at the squad and when you look at, let's say, the quality in the team, Feyenoord should be at least second. I think Ajax had a rough season last year. They're doing pretty well now, but also they're not playing the best football. They just have... I don't want to say luck, but they. In the end of the day, we should be above them for sure.
Yeah. Who are the players that are playing well at the moment? Because I look at kind of like recent results, and as you say, been a bit up and down. Who's the players that you can kind of rely on at the moment?
Now for sure, David Hanschko. He's our centre back. I mean, we were all super surprised that he was still playing at Feyenoord after the last transfer period. Actually, I mean, I believe you have a lot of injuries now in the centre-back position. Could be a good signing for you too in the wintertime.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he able to stick a blue shirt on for this week? Because we're playing youngsters at the moment.
I hope not. If you ask him, the answer might be different. But no, I mean, he is amazing. He's quick. He is strong. He is actually a goal scorer too. He scored a goal in he's international for Slovakia, and he scored against Sweden this week. He's the man, I would say, in the defense. And then we last summer we actually bought Imbum Wang, who is a midfielder, number six eight, and he has done absolutely amazing. We bought him from Red Star Belgrade, and he's just, from the moment that he came in, he's one of the leaders of the team. He's already 28, which is a surprise to us because he wasn't picked up by a better club earlier in his career, but we are super happy with him. And then, yeah, we have a couple of big players. I mean, Quinton Timber. I mean, Timber, the name you know from his brother, I think, who's playing at Arsenal. He's our captain, very strong player, very good number eight. But he has been a bit up and down with his fitness lately. So, the issue that Man City has with the fitness of their squad, Feyenoord has exactly the same. The only difference is that we can't pay, let's say, 40 contract players that all have a good quality. So yeah. we have let's say 13, 14 players who can actually, I think, play on the level of Champions League, and then after that or behind that, it will be going. Yeah, the quality is going down drastically. So that's a little bit of the issue. But I mean, Timber if he's fit, and I think he will play, then he's definitely one of the strongest ones.
Yeah. In terms of the Champions League, as you mentioned already, two wins, two defeats. What's your aim for the Champions League group this season? Because obviously you've got that top eight position that will get you automatically in, like, a little bit further on in the competition. But there's a good chance of qualification into the playoff round, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the aim for Feyenoord, especially when before the tournament started, we saw the draw. We had Benfica away, Girona away. For Feyenoord, also a difficult game. Bayern at home, Man City away. I mean, these are teams that normally are stronger than we are. So, I mean, top 24 would be perfect. That's the goal. On the other hand, when we won against Benfica and Girona away, we started looking at the table and like, when we win Salzburg at home, then you have 9 points out of 4 matches. You never know what happens. But I mean, when we gave that one away, I think top 24, every Feyenoord fan will be signing for that.
Yeah, have you been better away from home? Because I've just noticed that both of your victories are away from home. You've lost both at home.
I know. I don't know what's happened. I mean, we scored, I don't know the exact statistics, but this season we scored maybe 32 goals and 24 of them were away, something like that. It was super weird, especially because Feyenoord always has been a club that was building on their fans. You know, we are a working class club. We kind of like Liverpool. The stadium is so important for us. But this year, it seems the opposite.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Let's have a look at the style of play as well, because like City quite often this season have struggled with teams counter-attacking and trying to hit them in transition. How strong are you in transition at the moment?
Pretty strong, I would say, especially when you look at the games of Benfica against Benfica. But I mean, the normal way of playing for Feyenoord is very, let's say, in position, attacking. I mean, again, not to talk about Liverpool too much, but I mean, you know, the way Arne Slot is playing with Liverpool now, that's kind of what we do in the Eredivisie. So a lot of position, a lot of let's say, attacking football. So we are not a counter team. But I mean, if you look at the game, Man City away, it would be a bit stupid, I think, to only think about how we would like to play and more like how do you need to play.
Yeah.
So we have a couple of pretty quick attackers. Paixão is one of them, the left winger. They have a lot of speed. So if I would be the head coach of Feyenoord, I think I would build a defense and then try that.
Yeah. Have you been quite strong defensively this season?
Yeah, pretty much. Last year we were better. But I mean, with Hanschko in centre back together with Trauner, who is an Austrian international, I'm not so worried about the defence.
Yeah, it's a weird one at the moment as well, because I think a lot of people look at City and certainly worry about City's attacking prowess. But if you can keep Erling Haaland quiet, City are actually struggling for goals right now. How do you feel coming up against someone like him?
Yeah, I mean, it's always nice. I mean, we have a couple of players, especially Thomas Bailey. He's a young centre-back. I'm not sure if he will play, but he makes a lot of minutes. It's almost a little bit funny to see him play against Haaland, I think, because Haaland is such a beast, you know, and such a world star. And then Thomas Bailey used to play in the second league last year, 2 years ago. But luckily, our centre-back, Gernot Trauner, he's playing for the Austrian national team, and he has some experience to play against Haaland, because last October, they played against each other, Austria against Norway, 5-1. And the one goal wasn't scored by Haaland for Norway. So, I mean, Gernot Trauner has the experience to pocket him. Let's say it like that. So we have full belief in him that he will do it again away at the Etihad. But I'm looking forward to it, actually. I'm a striker myself, not on a very poor level, I must say. But I mean, Haaland is obviously, he's a star. And we are very much looking forward to playing him. And I think the squad is the same. I mean, how often do you play games against Man City, against these world-class players, you know?
Yeah. Just thinking ahead to the game then in the midweek next week, we have a charity bet on the show a bit later on. I like to chicken out of this and give my bet over to guests. So how do you think the game's going to go, and what's your score prediction for it?
Oi, okay. Obviously, we had in 2017, we played away at Man City. I'm not sure if you recall.
Yeah.
Do you know the score?
It was a last minute 1-0, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Sterling, 88 minutes. And that was actually, we lost at home with 4-0, I think, 4-0. And then we were all a bit shaky to go up to the Etihad. And then we played a pretty good game. And with a bit of more luck, I think we could have got a draw. So let's say a draw. I think 1-1. Haaland didn't score too often lately, right? He scored a lot in the beginning, but I don't think he will score this time. Is Nathan Ake playing?
That's a good question. He's been injured and he's close to fitness, so he could be available.
Okay. Obviously, he learned all his good stuff at the Feyenoord Academy. So I think Ake will score the 1-0, and then Julian Carranza, our third striker, because the first two are injured, he will score the equaliser in the 88th minute.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
That was Luke Flens talking to me about Feyenoord. It's charity bet time. We are still on £595 raised for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group so far this season. And we have a £10 correct score single on City's games from William Hill. We heard from Jack earlier on that he was going for a 3-0 or a 4-0 win for City against Spurs. I pushed him and he's settled on 3-0. So that's 12-1 and £120 if he's right. Rachel, what are you having for the Spurs game?
I'm going to go 3-1 City.
3-1
Son
City.
Son to score.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe even first. A 3-1 comeback. It's that kind of feels like how it has to go, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think we'll be keeping a clean sheet, though, that way.
Yeah. 11-1 and £110 if you're right. Richard, what are you having?
I share the lack of confidence in a clean sheet, so I'm going City to win 2-1.
2-1 is 15-2 and £75 if you're right. That takes us to Feyenoord. Richard, we'll stick with you. What are you having?
I'm going City to win 2-0, and I hope that I am really, really undercooking that one.
Yeah, it's a weird one, this, because that's 13-2 and £65. So it's one of those that it feels like the bookmakers feel is quite likely. So there we go. We heard from Luke that he's gone for a 1-1 draw. That's 14-1 and £140 if he's right. Rachel, give us the good news. Come on, what have you gone for?
4-2, City win. I think just based on the fact that they've gone to some difficult places and scored multiple goals, and coupled with the fact that defensively we still look a bit fragile. So, yeah, 4-2 City win.
4-2 City win. I'll bite your hand off for, because that's 40-1 and £400 you'll add to the kitty if you are right. You'll practically double the pot if you're right with that one. So fingers crossed. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change, and check out begambleaware.org for information on responsible gambling. Now, on Saturday, Taylor Harwood-Bellis became the 19th different player to score at international level, having graduated from the City Academy. There are some odd stories regarding some of the others who have done the same. Dan Burke has been looking at the full list.
There are obviously players who came through at City and went on to play for their national team before 1998, but that's where we start, because that's when the FA granted the club academy accreditation under the new youth system. It means Sean Wright Phillips was the first graduate.
Sean Wright Phillips, who's really, really quick, takes on Rousseau. Story. Sean Wright Phillips picked up that loose ball, accelerated towards the Ukraine goal, scored not a dissimilar goal to this in a pre-season friendly for Manchester City.
That was a trademark Wright Phillips goal, drilling it low and hard across the keeper as England beat Ukraine 3-0 at St James's Park in August 2004. But despite being the first academy graduate, he's probably not the first to score for his country. It might be Chris Killen, as Mooney explains.
He played for New Zealand before he'd ever made his senior club debut. He played in 2000 against Tahiti, 3 months before he ever played at club level. Now, his first goal for New Zealand, we know he scored, I think he scored about 16 in total, but the records online are really, really difficult to work out. So I've not been able to find out who it was against, his first goal, or when it was. So he may even have scored that first goal before he ever played for City. Which would certainly put him in a very exclusive club. But maybe some listeners in New Zealand who remember his international career could help us out a bit here, because I just cannot find any information about who Chris Killen scored against at international level.
Next up, there were a couple of Irish Stevens that became the third and fourth scorers for their country after coming through the City Academy. Stephen Elliott got the only goal in a 1-0 win over Cyprus in October 2005, before Stephen Ireland opened the scoring in what would turn out to be a 5-2 defeat to Cyprus in October 2006. Then, in September 2007, Micah Richards scored for England against Israel. Ian Wright and the panel on Match of the Day were impressed.
We know he's capable of this in the box, but if you watch his movement here, he gets into a nice... And then he's just really... All he's got to do is just leap there, really. I think it's bad marking on there.
Keeper wasn't happy.
I think Michael does really well.
Michael does well for him.
Michael, just a step to the left.
Just look, bang.
The keeper just runs into him.
Mike hasn't really had to do much, but... just get up higher than everyone else here, but like, you know, it's brilliant.
Not a bad player.
He is a player, by the way, Micah Richards.
8 months later, there was another Academy graduate on the score sheet for his country. Ched Evans scored on his Wales debut, and then, 4 months on, Glenn Whelan scored for Ireland against Georgia. He spoke to RTE.
Obviously, to come away and to get 3 points is fantastic for the team, but to score as well for myself gives me great confidence.
What about the goal that you scored, though, before we talk about that? It was about 30 yards out, I'm sure. Did you decide that he wasn't the greatest keeper you've ever come up against and have a pot?
Well, I heard the fans shouting and shouting a little bit, and just a little bit of room opened up, but it moved a little bit in the air, but I think the keeper should have known a little bit better with it.
Next up, Vladimír Weiss scored his first goal for Slovakia in October 2010. And then there was a blast from the past. The ninth player to become an international goalscorer after graduating from the City Academy made his only City appearance in 2001. But 10 years later, Terry Dunfield found the net for Canada in a friendly against Ecuador.
First one for Canada, it's brilliant.
How do you feel?
Yeah, I've been waiting and dreaming of that day for 29 years, so it's pretty special.
Talk about the goal celebration. It's becoming a bit of a trademark.
It is now. Yeah, no, it was the fans were going crazy over there, and you know, I just wanted to go over and celebrate with them. And you know, it's a great feeling having 10 other guys follow you in as well.
Daniel Sturridge also had to wait for his first international goal. He played for City for the first time in 2007 and then opened his England account in March 2013 with the 7th in an 8-0 win in the World Cup qualifiers against San Marino. Then, in 2015, Emir Hughes scored his only goal for Wales.
Taken quickly, Allen.
That was in November 2015, on the same day that Bersant Salina opened his account for Kosovo. Mooney's been looking at a run of players at that time who all played a little bit for City and then scored for their country.
Salina's an interesting one because he hadn't made his debut for City when he scored for Kosovo. His debut for City came in 2016. That was an FA Cup tie against Norwich. But obviously in November 2015, he scored a penalty for Kosovo against Albania in an international friendly. Around about that same time, impressing in the City first team was Kelechi Iheanacho. At the end of that 15-16 season, when he'd kind of burst onto the scene, he was rewarded with a call-up for Nigeria. So he scored for Nigeria against Mali in a friendly in May 2016. And then a blast from the past, John Guidetti scored for Sweden against Wales. That was another friendly. That was in June 2016. It was about a year after he'd left City as well. He'd struggled with injury at City and eventually left in July 2015. A year later, scored for Sweden.
That brings us to Phil Foden, who scored his first England goals in the Nations League in a 4-0 win over Iceland. He's the only Academy graduate to score a brace when opening his account for his country. Here's his then national team manager, Gareth Southgate, after that game.
It took him a few days, I think, to settle into the camp and start to smile a bit more and relax a bit more. And important, we got him on the pitch against Ireland. And then tonight, we felt was a really good game for him. So, yeah, I'm really pleased. We know what he's capable of doing, and he's one of a few that are going to be very exciting over the next few years for England.
Next is a player who has two first international goals. here's Mooney again.
The curious case of Brahim Diaz. Yeah, he's the only player that appears twice on this list because he has scored for two different countries. He scored on his one and only Spain appearance in June 2021. That was in a friendly against Lithuania. But then he switched allegiances and decided to declare for Morocco. And then in September 2024, so only a few weeks ago, he scored against Gabon in the AFCON qualifying. So he is the only City Academy graduate to have scored for two different countries.
In the middle of those two Brahim Diaz goals, Oscar Bob opened his Norway account too. He spoke to City TV recently about the start to his international career.
It was another dream, playing with Erling, Odegaard. Yes, it was very good.
And then soon after, first goal.
Yeah.
How much of a whirlwind was that? Like, it all happened so quickly, right?
Yeah, it was Faroe Islands. Mm. It was at home, it was freezing, but yeah, it was a great moment.
Freezing, it's cold in Norway all the time, though.
Yeah, it was like minus 10, 11, I don't know.
Bob obviously impressed from the City Academy last season. Also impressing was Cole Palmer, although he'd already left for Chelsea by the time he got his England call-up. His first goal came from the penalty spot against Bosnia and Herzegovina in a friendly last June, and he spoke to Channel 4 about it afterwards.
It's a great feeling, my first goal for your country. You know, everyone wants to score for the country, so when it went in, it was buzzing.
And the timing wasn't bad either, was it? Because I think there was a certain England captain ready to come on and potentially take that penalty.
You know, yeah, of course he would have took it, but, you know, yeah, it was just before he came on, so thankfully I got to score.
And that leaves us with Taylor Harwood-Bellis, who scored his first international goal on Sunday, 5 years after making his first appearance for City's first team from the academy. It means a total of 19 players have now scored for their countries, having cut their teeth in the game at either Main Road or the Etihad. And there'll no doubt be many more to come in the not-too-distant future.
I'm Terry Phelan, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was Dan Burke looking at City's academy graduates that have scored for their countries. And now, back by popular demand, it's this.
It's the listeners' questions. It's the listeners' questions. Don't be giving us lots of flannel or suggesting it's Ask the Panel, because it's not called that. All right. It's called It's the Listener's Questions. Make it thoughtful or inventive. Try to provide an answer incentive. It's the listener's questions. Thank you.
You know, you don't include that jingle for 1 week and the amount of flack you get in the neck for it, Richard, it's incredible.
Every time I hear it, I always worry that he's going to sort of go too fast for himself and trip over his words. And every time he pulls it out the bag and nails it. I do realise it's a pre-recording.
I was going to say, it's almost like it's a recording, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Right, get in touch on Twitter, at Blue Moon Podcast. We've got a Blue Sky account if you want to get in touch on there. That is, just search for at Blue Moon Podcast on there as well. And you can email through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com. Just fill in the form and send us an email that way. That's exactly what Stephen has done. He says, we've had weeks of negativity in the City fan base, so let's hear about your favourite pre-takeover game and pre-takeover goal, and your favourite post-takeover game and post-takeover goal. The only restriction is that they can't be any of the obvious, so no Aguero against Queen's Park Rangers and no Dickoff against Gillingham. I should say that Stephen sent this in before the news of Guardiola's contract extension came about, because there's obviously been quite a lot of positivity in the day after that. I guess this is looking at favourite games and goals that are not immediately obvious, Richard. So what are you having?
This is a great question. So I'll go goal first, because I've got one that springs to mind from when I did the Patreon on 10 like favorite goals at home, yeah, goals or something, or whatever it was we recorded. And it's a bit of a, like, if I really took my time to think about it, I probably wouldn't settle on it as my very favorite, but I'll, for speed, I'll throw it out there. Ian Bishop at home to Leeds in
what
the FA
goal.
Cup.
Yeah.
Because City had already been 1-0 up in that game. So for context, City were doing well in Division 1, as it was at the time, Championship in new money, and Leeds were an exceptional Premier League team. Harry Kewell, Lee Bowyer.
I can tell you, it was top of Division 1 against top of the Premier League.
Yeah, and it was like Leeds, I went away from that game thinking, Jesus Christ, Premier League football is a different standard. Like, I couldn't believe the pace of them. City went 1-0 up in that game, and that was already, and really early on, and that was like roof off main road kind of atmosphere when it went in. And then Leeds equalised pretty quickly, and it's like, well, okay, back down to earth with a bump. And then, as I recall it, City go on the attack again fairly quickly. The ball falls to Bishop somewhere around the edge of the penalty area, or maybe more like sort of adjacent to the corner of the, like, the D. He's probably about 20 yards out, and he takes a touch and then just laces it straight as an arrow into the top corner. And again, it was like, just if the roof had come off after the first one, it was like it blew it to space with the atmosphere after the second one. It was like, we are really in this game. We are beating a Champions League team. We are beating one of the best teams in the country with, like, Boya, Kuhl, some of these, like, really exciting players. Hopefully I'm not misremembering that they were playing, but they were certainly Leeds players at the time. And City went on to get beat 5-2. And, like, that was absolutely fine. It was fair. Leeds were, like I say, just an astonishingly good team. But to have that moment at a point when City didn't get a lot of those moments because we weren't playing against that level of team. And as a young fan, like, that being really my first experience of watching us against the top Premier League team in my match going life, it was just absolutely brilliant, and I have very, very fond memories of it. So of course there's, like, there's derby goals, there's promotion goals, but to take the spirit of the question and go with something a bit less obvious, then I'm going to throw that one in there.
Yeah. Rachel, any favourite pre-takeover goals for you like that?
So I've gone for a goal in the same game, so it's my favourite pre-takeover game, but also one of my favourite goals from that game. And I've gone for, and probably this is just still the sort of nostalgia in me, and because I'm a lady of a certain vintage, that the demolition derby of September 89. And I mean, obviously we went into that game in a really poor vein of form. United weren't actually that much better from memory either. They were having a sort of minor blip by their standards. I think they'd just signed Gary Pallister, who was having a bit of a nightmare. That said, we hadn't, you know, we were pretty much given next to no chance of winning that game. The fact that we beat them in the manner which we did, with a whole raft of homegrown players as well at the time, you know, with the likes of David White and Hinchcliffe, Paul Lake, who obviously featured and was brilliant that day. And my favourite goal, and again, I think this is just because I'm probably being a little bit nostalgic, is the one with the commentary that was played over and over again. My VHS was worn out, which was the final goal, early cross, chance at the far post, Hinchcliffe. That's just marvellous stuff. Remember that David White from the wing and that bullet header from Andy Hinchcliffe.
For a minute, I really hoped, given what Richard had said, I really hoped it was Ian Bishop's header. But, you know, because the fact that Ian Bishop didn't score that many goals, the fact that you both picked a goal again with him scoring in, yeah.
No, it was brilliant. And I still really enjoy, you know, when they do their sort of montages of Premier League, of derbies from years gone by, whenever that comes up, it still warms the cockles of my heart.
Yeah, I'm going to chuck in, I'm not going to go too long, but I'm going to chuck in Mark Kennedy at Blackburn, because that whenever that is on Sky and I end up sitting down to watch it, that's the point at which I always end up crying again, because I was 12 years old and I remember that, like, really understanding that City were going up at that point when he scored that. And like you say, the commentary is with the Hinchcliffe goal, the commentary with that one's perfect as well. It's one of them where I just have to sit down whenever it's on Sky, that game, I have to sit down and watch it, because it just takes me back to being a child. Richard, post takeover, any non-obvious favourite games and goals?
Well, I've already done... Oh, post-takeover. I was going to say I've already done goal. I've not.
are you goal, all right?
No, I've no idea what's going on. I've lost myself. Right, so, favourite goal, just for non-obvious, Tevez free kick against Stoke after the FA Cup final in the league game against them, because it was just a bit of a sense of, God, everything is just going our way. Like, we were on the run to finish it in the top four at that point, and that goal was insane. He was so far out, like the curve that he got on it was was absolutely ridiculous. And it just felt like we were into sort of proper end of the season party time. And then post takeover favourite game that's non-obvious. I'm maybe stretching the spirit of that question because maybe this is obvious because it was such a big game and such a, I suppose, quite a famous result, but it wasn't a trophy game. So I'm going to take it as non-obvious in that sense. The 2-1 against Liverpool in 2019, turn of the year. If Liverpool would have won, they would have been 10 points clear. They hadn't lost a game all season. They didn't lose any more games that season. It was absolutely shit or bust for City. And they went 1-0 up with that ridiculous angled Aguero goal that produced there's a photo of his celebration after that game, which is one of my favourite after that goal, sorry, which is one of my favourite City photos. Liverpool equalise and you start to think, oh god, we're not going to beat them. And then Sané goes up the other end and scores. Bernardo broke records for how much he ran. The atmosphere was one of the best atmospheres I think we've had at the Etihad.
And we did the podcast outside afterwards.
We did, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just an absolutely fantastic result, fantastic night, and it got better. Like by the end of the season, I suppose that game then becomes more mythologized, because if we'd have dropped one more game in towards the end of the season, then we wouldn't have won the league, and that game starts to matter much less in the memory. Also, the game, of course, with the John Stones, clearance, 11 millimeter yeah. clearance, just great. One of my absolute favorite City games. Loved yeah. it.
And Rachel, post takeover for you?
Well, yeah, I really struggled with this because a lot of them are the obvious ones. So Kompany against Leicester was obviously phenomenal. And Kompany against United in the 1-0 on the Monday night football. If you remember, it was billed at the time as the biggest game in football in history ever. That would have been in the 2012 season, wasn't it? Just in our running to win our first title. So that one was pretty special. But on a personal note, I went to Schalke away February 2019 with my dad, my brother, my son. And I don't know if you remember, but Sterling got a 90th minute winner.
Yeah,
we'd been behind. Otamendi had been sent off. Sane scored a late goal in the 85th minute, which I think was that the free kick?
Yeah, free kick.
And then Sterling had a bit of an individual effort on the 90th minute, and we all just went ballistic. So I just think, from a personal perspective, to have my dad there, who's been a Blue all his life, as my brother and my son, I think at the age of what we would have been 17, 18 then, just sort of enjoying his first European away trip, it was just great us all being there and enjoying that moment. So yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah,
there's so many that you could pick out, and we're so fortunate in that we've had so many of these moments over the years. But yeah, that's the one for me.
Yeah, great days. Get in touch with yours. We'd like to hear them. You can email us. Just go to the website, bluemoonpodcast.com, fill in the form, get your questions in for future shows. But do let us know your favourite pre- and post-takeover games and goals that are not the obvious ones, because I do like the obscure from time to time. And that's it for this episode of the Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And thanks also to my guests for this one, Rachel Hurdson.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
And Richard Burns.
Thank you very much, David.
There is a clip of this week's Nostalgia Show on the way. That was a Heaven and Hell episode about games with Chelsea. Me and Dom Farrell were joined by Dan Childs from Son of Chelsea to discuss those four games. If you'd like to listen, you can sign up with a 7-day free trial first as well at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. Don't forget, you can also now buy a Patreon membership for a friend or family member. Maybe for Christmas, I don't know. I could be nudging you that way as we get closer to the end of December. You can do that by going to gift.bluemoonpodcast.com and you can select the FA Cup winning tier, and then they can hear all of the Patreon shows as we do them. I'll be back next week after the dreaded game with Spurs, looking ahead to the dreaded game at Anfield. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can, and don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Didn't Fabregas end up stacking it like
over the hoardings? Yeah,
yeah.
He kept on backing up, didn't he? And like he knew Fernandinho had lost it, and like Fabregas was like accidentally on purpose going to fall over the advertising hoardings because he knew what was going to happen.
Fabregas is properly pantomime. Like that was when it became full. Like OK Corral, like the Western doors, the swinging doors in a tavern. Man falls over the bar, pints everywhere sort of thing. admittedly, at that point, with the game being gone, I do remember being in the, when you're sitting in the stand thinking, I can appreciate this is quite funny. Yeah, that was mad. Because the thing is, I know you like a Simpsons reference, David, but like, Aguero yes. being like the smiliest, happiest guy around. David Luiz was like his monobrow baby to Maggie Simpson. Like, yeah. All the time.
No, I don't know what caused it. Like, even you go back years to the game at Wembley where he just two-foots him out of nowhere. Just like two-foots him on the arse.
And that was a game where Aguero played really well, scored a wonderful goal. Everyone's having a nice time. And then he just like went in raging on David Luiz. The thing is, and this is mad when you look at their overall careers, in that little rivalry, David Luiz comes out as the level-headed one, doesn't he?
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.